Oh, thank you.
Well, sir.
It's going to be brief. We'll be switching this off a lot. Hello. Greetings. I'm not sure how to turn this up, and I'm not sure if it needs to be turned up.
No, it's fine.
It's fine? Okay. Very good. I'm Bert Main. I've spoken to a lot of you on the phone. Welcome to Albany. Those of you that are here for the first time, or even those of you that aren't here for the first time, ought to know that this is the tricentennial up here. So you're liable to see a whole bunch of hoopla about the city being 300 years old. Parts of it look it. All in all, it's a nice place. And for those of you that are going to be sticking around until Monday, it's going to be a lot of fun. We have a bus set to go up to Saratoga. It'll be leaving here around 11 o'clock, so we'll be up there in plenty of time. I'll need to get a count later on of the all those who are interested in the banquet Sunday night, which is a totally optional thing, and the bus trip up on Monday, which again is completely optional. But we thought that this would be a good way to have the probable final East Coast seminar done up in style, would be to have something like the bus tour and the banquet. So there is a fellow who will be coming in a little later to tell you a little bit more about the bus trip also, and some possibilities on that trip to Saratoga. At any rate, I need to know for the catering service here how many we'll have on Sunday. And so maybe during the first break, you can get in touch with me. A number of you have spoken up for the banquet and the bus already, and I've got a list. But I know there are some other people who will be interested and some folks who had thought they'd be able to that won't be able to, and one thing and another. So just make sure you see me during the first break, because first thing in the morning I've got to tell the man how many we're going to have for our banquet. I guess to get things rolling right along, why don't I introduce Dr. Howard Sarton, who is the guru of the group.
That is, that's all I get.
Well, I was gonna say something on the way down. I hadn't expected applause.
I hadn't either. Maybe we better quit right there and say it later.
With a sandal and all, see, we were going to try and rig this with my full beard and clerical occupation. We were going to try and fix the swimming pool out there so that he could impress you all by walking across it to get there. But we decided that would be a little showy, you know, possibly ostentatious, so we abandoned that plan. But I first wrote to this man probably 2 years ago, convinced that he was a charlatan and a rogue, but I was going to give him a chance, you know, that kind of thing. So instead, he gave me a chance and put up with a lot of letters and phone calls and all of that. And finally, I'm convinced. So I have been playing up at Saratoga, and everything you'll hear tonight and tomorrow and Sunday is true. You're not going to hear a lot of garbage that you don't need to hear. You'll hear things that seem too simple, and some of the things are simple but not easy. And I won't lie to you and tell you I'm having a lot of luck at Saratoga. Because luck has nothing to do with it. What I'm doing is winning 80% of the time at Saratoga. And that ain't luck. I am not a notably lucky person, so I'm not having any luck at all at Saratoga. All I'm doing is having a heck of a lot of success because I'm doing exactly what the Sarton methodology tells me. Doc.
Thank you.
Roy Taylor. I think you need one of these. We get Joe, how does that come off?
We're using this microphone. And it will be somewhat clumsy, as each speaker will have to put it on, because Joe Ray will stand among you. Joe Ray, many of you have dealt with Joe. Joe makes complete audio tapes of the seminar, about 12 to 14 hours of them, sometimes more. He usually cuts me off in my most emotional peaks, the end.
Not again.
But Joe sells these then at cost. I think his maximum cost has been $40 to $45 for 18 hours and $35 for less. But I guarantee you that when you get them, they will be clear because of this procedure. And they should be well worth the pittance that he charges for them. They, of course, are optional. Thank you all very much for coming. We are not about to die despite my limp. The reason that we have not planned any future East Coast seminars is not that we are in any way forsaking you. We have figured up the cost of what it costs you to come to an East Coast hotel, averaging $75 to $90 a night, and the airfare, and figured that we can do seminars in Las Vegas, where room rates are $22, and food is one-eighth of the cost of what it is in a restaurant here, You can also have the pleasure of going to Las Vegas and have the immediacy of horse books for your continued betting, and all of you fare with less expense to yourselves. And our capacity then would be doubled to bring you more unstructured. So I think it would be better if we'd all consider, perhaps in the future, going to Las Vegas. Any of you not think that's a good idea? The time structure is the same. The cost would ultimately be less, and you'd have more opportunity to recoup the money you pay out from the opportunities that are just manifold in Las Vegas for small betting and relatively large wins because of the quinella. And then we would concentrate there on how to win off track even more than we do in these kinds of seminars. We started something a few years ago in our seminars which created a little bit of controversy. We had an invocation. The Kiwanians do it, the Rotarians do it, the Lions do it. And I don't know why those people need invocations. All they do is go around and play jokes on each other and everything. Why would a Lion and a Rotarian and a Kiwanian need an invocation and not someone who needs the gods more than any? A handicap. Now, for those of you who are not Christians and who are offended by invoking the Christian God, don't worry about it. Most people who are Christians are not Christians. They've got a place up there, you know, where they put them. And when the rest of us go by, they say, shh, be quiet, they think they're the only ones here. The invocation is not a byproduct of the born-again Christians or any of the Orthodox religions. In fact, all great warriors in the past did an invocation. An invocation is merely invoking the gods, whichever gods you may believe in, to be in your behalf when you go into the battle. And what could be a more strenuous battle than the one we wage against the paramutual machines and against those idiots whose money we must take? There is one, I've known two Christians in my life. My father, who died, and Bert Maynard, is not feeling so well. The rest of them merely professed and called themselves thusly. So for our invocation, I could think of no one I'd rather give it than the Reverend Bert Maynard. And I know that the Lord will forgive this electronic contrivance.
Let us pray. Great God, you've been called by many names. You've been seen in different guises throughout the millennia. Your presence has been felt in countless ways and doubted in almost as many. Intoning myriad names, people have called to you at the outset of every sort of undertaking. The gladiators sought in you the assurance that they would live to see their victory. The troops in numberless battles have hoped your favor rested on their cause. Those whose mythic quests carried them to risk the uncharted seas and the trackless wastes of this earth asked only that you accompany their way. Mystics and priests, druids, mages, sorcerers and monks, philosophers and all seekers after truth, each and all who quest after the light, seek first your blessing and want your aid along their travels. We are seekers. We are questing. We ask your light. You have names known and unknown. We dare to ask your blessing and your presence. You have names spoken and unspoken. We would come to know that which the ordinary person despairs of ever knowing. We would have in our possession that which lesser spirits say does not exist. We would risk comfort, forswear laziness, and wage the struggle to rise to free heights known to few and none without courage. There are here some who, because of their fears or dependency or laziness, will be tempted to want to be led by the hand and shown every inch of the way they must go. Help them to come to see that this cannot be, for no one can take us where we must go ourselves. And to earn freedom is in part to be alone. Let us each seek to arrive at the point at which we take responsibility for our own destinies and captain our own ships where we are now bound. Grant us your presence, that we might think new thoughts and dream new dreams, and dare, will, know, and become more than we have been. Help us in our struggle for the radical freedom of truth. This is what we ask. Amen.
That was very good, Reverend Burt. Thank you very much. Thus started, how can we fail but to accomplish our task?
I'm going to run up and see if we can get more water for everybody back in here in the setups that way. So I'll be right back.
How many preachers you get give you an invocation and go fetch the water? Thank you. You're a better man than I am, Gungadin.
That's phase six.
He changes it into wine only after the seminar is over. For those of you who are new to us, welcome. How many of you are new to us who have never been to a seminar and who have, there's quite a few new people here. This is the most new people we've ever had. For those of you who are new, we intend that you shall not be new beyond this initial moment. There are nine of us here who you'll meet in a few moments, who will dedicate our waking hours to helping you catch up. You're probably sitting next to someone who will also be very happy for you to catch up. To refresh you all, we have an organization known as PERCO. That stands for Paramutual Information and Research Company. There are in that organization some 14 or 15 charter members, half of which are here, persons who are doing between 70% and 80% consistently at every track in the country. That is the first prerequisite. The second is that they've all been cut off by their bookies at least once. The essence of the Sardin methodology is not handicapping or handicapping instruction. It is winning. We are not theorists. We don't have a bunch of concepts. We don't have a bunch of rules. And we don't rehash the truths, myths, and half-truths of the past. We present you a very simplistic methodology, which is complex only in the fact that I made it complex, purely and simply because if you say it's simple, everybody will treat it simply, and it'll never work. Those of you who have found it complex and difficult and who have paid your dues and who have understood it are winning. Those who looked for a simple method with a set of rules because of their rabbinical training or their Christian equivalent of rabbinical training, which says that all life is a set of rules and all things must be guided by a set of rules, will not be here or at any forthcoming seminar or at any past one, for they have already abandoned the quest that Burt talked about in his invocation. Had Christopher Columbus decided to sit in the Genoese garden instead of importuning kings for the funds to find and chart a new world, we would not have a lot of things, among them Columbus Day, Columbus Square, and Michael Pozzola. Was that all right? He said, don't make any mafia jokes. So I'm going back to a much nobler form of Italian. He says it's much too close to home to make them on the East Coast. Make them on the West Coast, it's okay.
For a Spanish beer.
Our concept is winning. We don't care. We don't care about the theories. We don't care about arguing what ifs. You will not get any what ifs or any rules or any theories or any concepts that are indigenous to our own warps or our own prejudices. You will get only a formula for winning. And winning is not just handicapping. In fact, handicapping is merely the tip of the iceberg of winning. Anybody who is worth their salt in this business, and there are a few, James Quinn, Andy Beyer, Bill Quirin, all of these gentlemen will prefer to you information, but they will also tell you that it is within the heart and soul and mind of the individual as to whether he utilizes that information to win winning is a private and lonely and individual occupation. Jimmy Quinn has done a marvelous job in depicting the difference between someone who is selection-oriented and a person who is decision-oriented. The selection process of picking horses is not difficult. Is there anyone in this room who cannot, in their own privacy of their own home, with a racing form in hand, sit down and with a computer, or if they're not yet using one, with a, pick a fair share of winners? Anybody who cannot do that? That means all of you can. And yet the same person who can make those selections, when you get to the racetrack, do you act upon those selection processes, or are there those peripheral things that enter into your life that make you fail to then put the proper amounts on the proper horses so that you come away with a profit? Any of you find the difficulty of making the transition for that easy process you found in the privacy of your own home to the more difficult at the racetrack? Anybody who've had that problem? I guess that's why we're all here, isn't it? That is a problem, as all of you who have been to seminars before are aware, is a problem of human ego state. The human ego state is that which we demonstrate and manifest in our behavior. And in the privacy of our own home, we are secure, free from anxiety, free from the need of making a decision, a wager, and from having to stand behind the outcome of that decision. Therefore sets in that psychological term for indecision, which is known as abuya. I like abuya better than indecision. It's a shorter, easier word. Think of it in terms of when you have an anxiety neurosis, it's just the same as the warrior who was threatened with death when he went into conflict, or that strange thing, the first man, when he saw the first lightning bolt and heard the first clap of thunder. It is fear, and fear causes indecision. Fear causes an emotional overcoming of ourselves and our intellect, because fear is a protective device. We operate solely from the adrenal child when we're under a state of fear, whereas when we're in the privacy of our own home making those selections, we are totally free from anxiety and fear. So just as much as undertaking the pursuit of the solution to the problems of the handicapping arts and sciences, we are determined to provide you with some answers for within your own heart and soul or psyche to overcome the anxieties and fears that exist between the selection process and the decision process. And we have with us 9 people who have all managed to overcome them. They are not 9 people who never had the fears. They are not 9 people who were never told by mommy and daddy, the preacher, the rabbi, and the teacher, that gambling is evil and you should therefore not do it. They have all undergone every fear, every social prejudice and stigma that any of us have gone through. But they overcame. They overcame by making themselves whole and by determining for themselves that the pursuit of handicapping as a successful endeavor in life was not an evil manifestation of a lazy, slovenly kid who wanted to just be a lazy gambler, but one of the highest of endeavors that a human being could strive for. One-tenth of 1% of the people who go to the racetracks make enough money to come home consistently winners of enough money to sustain themselves or to augment their living. 99.9% of the people lose. It is those who lose whose money we take. On a given day, 5% will win, but 4.9 of the 5% win because of luck, strange circumstances, betting on the purple silks, and the jockey in the third hole on the pink horse, the gray horse. Only 0.1% of the people win consistently. And what would happen if more than 0.1% of the people won? The pari-mutuel system demands that only that number win, that percentage win. Otherwise, we have nothing but minus pools. Otherwise, we have mutuals that are so low that it isn't worth the effort. We must accept the very, very sobering fact that if there weren't 99.9% of the people losing or insufficiently winning, then we could not ever hope to make or augment our living from thoroughbred racing. That is the absolute dictum of the pari-mutuel machine, and it is like death and taxes. There's no escaping it. As more states open for pari-mutuel betting, there will be more people who will win. The gross amount of people who win will be greater, but the percentage will never rise. Now, who are we going against? Who are we betting against? 5%. 20%, I should say. One out of every five, which is 20%, of people in our society are illiterate, functionally illiterate. Have you all read that? It's been in the papers, been on TV. And I'm not talking about ethnic groups or underprivileged groups. I'm talking about mainstream America. 20% of us are illiterate. Now that, I think more than 20% of the more of them go to the racetrack than there are in general society. Most of them are my clients, or have been once. I see people who tell me they're having problems, and I look at their manuals, and they're pristine, clean, unopened, uncreased. And I say, they say, well, didn't you just send that as something to wrap around the computer program? Actually, the manuals are for reading. The computer program is just secondary, really, to the manuals. Somebody says, hey, what's this going to do me any good? I haven't got the program yet. I said, when you understand this, you may not need the program. Jimmy Bradshaw uses the program only as an afterthought. When people are looking at him, he said, well, I better put it through the computer because the doc expects me to show him a readout. Michael Pozzola can look at a computer and suddenly says, well, he rubs it and gets the horses. They are helpful to confirm your judgments, but they are not the be-all and end-all of handicapping. The totality is what's important. The determination to be winners is what's important. If you want a method for just handicapping, it's a challenge. There are a lot of them on the market. In fact, you can get five a day out of the racing form. Keep you in challenges for the rest of your life. We do have people who write me who are, most of them belong to Mensa. Anybody here belong to Mensa? I wouldn't admit it either. They're the upper 0.1% of IQ in the people of the United States. Most Mensa people go through the procedure of handicapping as they would a chess game, but would never dirty themselves by going to a track and actually putting money on their selections. I have one fellow who's been with us since the very beginning, who talks about all the races he wins. He wins it all over the United States. He's never been out of Columbus, Georgia. He does it on paper, and that's a satisfying thing for him. But I don't think it would satisfy any of you. I don't think you would pay to come to a seminar just to win on paper. And our essence is to have you win money. Nothing delights me more, nothing delights my wife more, when she gets these calls all through the day and night, people telling her how much money they made. My daughter keeps saying, tell them to tithe, tell them to tithe. But she gets her gratification only in hearing people say they win. That is where we both get our gratification. And as we progress since our humble beginnings, we have more and more people call us who are winning, who have overcome those psychological obstacles that stand between making the selection and the decision. We have with us some fellows who we don't pay. They don't know that. So they think they're going to get paid when we get home. We give them their parking lot fee sometimes. And I'd like to introduce them in the order which they came to us. first give you some personal messages for those who couldn't make it. Glenn Smock had a very severe bout with diabetes and had to have special treatments not to lose a leg. Tom Brohammer was scheduled to come, wanted very much to come, but he has an outing with his family every year, a vacation which the whole family gets together. And unfortunately, he had to give in his desire to come to this to meet the family needs. His explanation to me in front of my wife was, "Howard, you know family comes first, don't you?" And my wife says, "No, Tom, he doesn't know that." With my family, unfortunately, I have to come first. And so it works, it's the same side of the other side of the same coin. But we have brought in his dad, Mr., our latest PERCO member, who has mastered this masterfully, Dick Schmidt. So when you look at Dick Schmidt, he's got Tom Brohammer's name on his room and on his airline ticket. Think of him as Tom Brohammer when you see him. That's the fact. Unlike Tom, Dick Schmidt can get it for you wholesale. He gets computers wholesale. In the order to which they came to us, I bring you the first PERCO member, outside of John Nick, who could not make it because we had some terrible stories here. His mother is terminal, and he had to stay in New Orleans. He was our first PERCO member. Our second PERCO member was Colonel Ron Bowman, who was living in Southern California, but who moved back to Canada because the Canadian Air Force check dwindled with the value of Canadian money in respect to the American, as some of you Canadians are very well aware. So he had to go back to Canada, A, to make his retirement from the Air Force mean something, and because the Canadians have a very civilized approach to health care, something that we haven't yet quite overcome. So I would live in Canada, too, if I could say dude in the boot right. And then there was Glenn Smock. And then there was this young man, he was young then, time has passed. This young man, one of our great success stories, he ordered the method, we sent it to him, and he called us all excited and said, "Hey, I got your method today." Or no, it was the day after. He says, "I got your method yesterday." "Oh, yeah, and I won a $68,000 pick six." Wonderful. See, that's the good news. Now, here's the bad news. I just opened it today. But outside of my own flesh and blood, he is the closest thing I have to another son. My Peck's bad boy son, Bob Purdy. You're supposed to make a speech. Try to, you know.
Clean it up.
Clean it up.
Clean it up.
Whoops.
Is it on?
Yeah. Everybody hear me all right?
Welcome to Albany. We're glad to be here. Nice to see some familiar faces, but new faces too. This ought to be a really good seminar. We've all looked forward to this. Just one comment I'd like to make. Anybody in here ex-Marines? Good. So am I.
Of course.
Once you master the method, my suggestion is that you all become ex-Marines and develop a killer instinct. Okay? Handicapping is not it's not a sport. It's not something that you do as a team. It's not a team effort. You do it all alone, and it's a lonely, hard work. You need that killer instinct. When you go to the track, you have to have your wits about you. You're out there for one reason only, and that's profit. And if that's not what you're after, then why are you going in the first place? Just develop that killer instinct. Learn the method first, and then go out. The person you see out there is walking around with your money in their pocket. Okay? And you want it. Okay? Get it. The method will give you the tools, and then you just have to develop that attitude.
Somebody's waving at you. You got a question?
Yeah. He doesn't have the bike within
Within range?
Well, that one doesn't matter. That one's only for the...
Oh, that's only for show?
That's for show.
What about your toy?
That's for the machine.
How's this? Better? I think this is the one that works. I don't think this one works, Aaron.
That one works on his machine only.
Hi, Joe. We'll be here for the whole seminar, obviously, and work with you. Any questions, we're all going to be glad to help. One word of caution. Howard's already mentioned it. When Michael says, don't tell mafia jokes, he means it. And his uncle will make sure you don't tell him. Thanks.
Next in order of arrival into the Perko Charter member group was a man who, there's two people you never make fun of here. You don't make fun of Michael's Italian ancestry or Richard Quigley's weight, because they're both very sensitive about it. But Richard Quigley was well known to many, and probably many of you, as the mutual clerk. It was an accomplished dog handicapper who made a very good living writing, lecturing, and handicapping the dogs. When the dogs started going to the dogs because of manipulation of tracks and whatever, and he had studied. Ray Talbot is very, very well represented here. The late Ray Talbot. Ray Talbot only lives in the American Turf Monthly office. They have a deodorant they spray in there regularly to keep him, because he's in the office, but they won't admit that he's not here. We have his former doctor here, Dr. Lerner, who you probably read in Phil's Racing newsletter. For the 15 months that Russ Dietrich was ill, Dr. Lerner dominated the pages with his methodology. So you want to... The famous Miami doctor was Ray Talbot's podiatrist, who taught him handicapping. Also at the feet of Ray Talbot and of Hugh Matheson, who were giants of their time, who first looked beyond just the common everyday concepts of go back 15 days and take the best race and look for the horse that earned the most and bet it or something. These two gentlemen were pioneers in their era, and a man who worked with them, close to them, along with our friend Lou Holloway, the late Lou Holloway, was another gentleman, a seat-of-the-pants handicapper from way back, but also a scientist and a methodologist. Richard Quigley. You've lost weight, Richard.
Yeah, I have to. I'm a little slow.
Very dramatic entrance.
Yeah, creeper.
I want to also tell you how happy I am to be here and welcome you all to Saratoga, especially the nice new shining faces out there. Certainly hope you will learn some things about the racing wars. I'm not going to talk very long. I'm not too glib on these things. We got a lot of guys that can really get up here and chuckle and make good jokes and things, but I will try to sort of put in the things that I've learned over the last first 25 years of handicapping and hook it up with the methodology and things on form, things on class, that will be insights and will help you sort of separate the wheat from the chaff. And I hope to help you all become better handicappers. Thank you.
Sit up here on the next spot. Richard may be shy now, but when he gets on that...
Well, I get curious.
Where are we getting billed? When we book him in to do this number, and then you got to worry about getting him off. The next in the long line of
members. I'm trying to be, I'll have to skip a few who couldn't make it. They're not here, but the persons who are here, the next in chronological order was the young man. Well, it's not really an ethnic slur to say he arrived with a sign on his chest from Sicily. It says W-O-P, which stands for without passport. We all wore those signs. But he learned the language as well as any of them do, I guess. In fact, they rewrote the language. They sang the songs, and they make the restaurant life of New York so interesting. And he actually studied to be a lawyer. Now, I'm not going to say anything about the syndicate because he asked me not to. So how can I best phrase how he got into handicapping? One of his uncles, who also was probably very, very offended by mafia-type jokes, said to Michael, "Michael, it is said that we can fix anything, but we cannot, and despite the terrible rumors that are rampant, we cannot find a way to fix the horses. So we want you to go out and find out how you can pick winners." Because it turns out that all his relatives were going to the track and everybody was betting what they were betting, thinking that they knew something. And they didn't. They were losing and they were very embarrassed by it. So they get Mike to law school and everything, and they wanted him to figure out what was winning races. So they put him through college just for that. And he finally learned. And he reports to his Uncle Guido. And he gets a little stipend from them. And he's one of our better teachers. In fact, he even learned to write and has contributed 25 pages to this manual. I give you a very dear young man, dear to all of us. And if you need anybody, you know, Michael Pozzola Jr. Don't you? No ethnic slurs.
And I always think it's going to be different. I don't even know anyone named Guido. Welcome. Welcome. I'm very happy to be at a seminar which is in my home state. And I'm really excited to be here and see so many new faces, so many people who are just beginning with the methodology and just learning. Because what we are here for, and what Dr. Sarton has always been here for all of us for, is to make us winners. It's to take us from a point of being non-winners to a point where we have mastery over, if not the most difficult, one of the most difficult games in the world that has ever been invented by man. Take a bunch of animals who have varying temperaments and are pretty... not the brightest in the animal kingdom. They're right below lawyers. Slightly above. Put small men who basically, most of whom can't speak English and have very small heads on top of them, and then try to predict in which order they will finish a mile and a half down the road. It's a very, very difficult game. Okay, and, you know, most horse players are a very, very funny lot. And this is perhaps the most important thing about learning to become a winning horse player. It's learning about what wins and what doesn't, what works and what doesn't. Not what theory is wonderful, or what horsey sayings you've heard are wonderful, or what seems to make you happy, but what wins, what actually works. That's what we're concerned about here, results. You know, psychologists tell about doing Howard should probably tell this, because I'm not a psychologist, but they tell about rats and how they train rats and watch them in a maze. And one experiment that they do is they take like six tubes, and they'll put some cheese at the end of, let's say, the fourth tube. And the rat goes looking for the cheese. He goes down the first tube, doesn't find any, so it comes out. He goes down the second tube and doesn't find any, comes out. Down the third tube, doesn't find it, comes out. Finally goes down the fourth tube, and hey, there's some cheese there. So they take the rat out after he eats the cheese, and they put him back in, and he'll go again through those four tubes until he finds the cheese at the end of the fourth tube. Well, after a few hundred times of doing that, the rat gets the idea, and he skips the first three tubes, and he runs down the fourth tube to get the cheese. So now he's got it figured out, and he knows that the fourth tube has the cheese. And then after they do that a few hundred times, they change the ball game on him, and they move the cheese away to another tube. Well, the rat will then still go down that fourth tube looking for the cheese. He'll be very confused. It's not there, and it'll come out. And he'll go right back up that fourth tube looking for the cheese and come out and come back, and he'll do that quite often. Now, the difference between horse players, most horse players, and rats is that eventually the rat stops going down that fourth tube. See, horse players are interested in which one is the right tube, which is the right theory, which is the belief that works best for them. Rats are only interested in cheese. And that's what we're interested in. We're interested in the results, winning, making money at the races, and predicting the outcome of the race. We have very little. Most of the things, most of Howard's theories, his theories of ultrascan, for example, gosh, the tandem concept, all of these concepts, most traditional handicappers scratch their heads and say that just doesn't make sense. My response to that is it may not be the right tube, but God knows it works, and it predicts winners. And this will be your most difficult task, especially those of you just beginning with the methodology, is putting aside those old concepts and old beliefs, which one is the right tube, and focusing on what works. You know, every teacher I've ever had who's been worth his salt, whether that be in law school, whether that be when I was training to be a magician, whether any teacher was worth his salt, said, look, you come to me as a teacher, put aside the stuff you think you know, and let me teach you what I know. And then you can go off and learn what you want. But what is required first, in fact, in ancient Indian writings, they talk about the relationship between a teacher and a student, that what the student has to do, he gets to pay one thing and he gets one thing back. And what he has to pay is something called a completely open mind. And what he gets back is the ability to ask any question. That's the deal that a teacher and student makes in the Indian system of education. What you need to do, especially if you're steeped in horsey sayings and steeped in things that are from ancient times, that, you know, days since, and workout patterns and all that kind of mechanical garbage that is put out under the guise of systems, is put all of that aside. Have a completely open and fresh mind, and then ask all the questions you can possibly come up with here. All of this is devoted to making you masters of the game. And sometimes, you know, teachers do very, very strange things to get their students to learn. I know Howard sent me out when energy first came out, and I was playing at Belmont with just the energy numbers. I didn't know what the heck to do with them, but eventually figured out some way to use them. Teacher that I had in another area, had his teacher sent him on a three-day walking trip to this other fellow clear across many towns to deliver a very important message. And when he got to that other person, that important message was, now send him back. Okay. When I think of all the time I spent mastering variance and then now realize I'm using ultrascan, I feel very much that way. But it's all part of the learning process and taking things absolutely apart, piece by piece. Your whole method of selecting horses, putting aside beliefs that you may have about average purse value, putting aside beliefs you may have about recency and form, and then after you've taken them apart and struggled with them, putting them back together into something which is much, much greater than the sum of all those little components, putting them back together in a way such that you become master handicappers and, more important, winners at this most difficult, most challenging, most wonderful game. And it's to that that Howard spends most of the waking hours and energy of his life completely devoted to. Almost every time that I've ever called him in the last few months, he's always out teaching, whether that be on a Saturday evening, on a Sunday, he's always with clients and teaching. It's an incredible amount of devotion to this man, devoted to transforming those who do not win at the races to winning horse players. It's almost a quixotic quest. It's a very amazing and wonderful job. But you've got to do your part. No one can chew your food for you. You can have the most wonderful banquet, but you've got to put it into your mouth and chew it and get the nourishment from it. And so for this weekend, and I look at the other PERCO members who are just incredible handicappers and winners, you've got quite a banquet here. Your job, have your open mind, ask away, and by the end of this seminar, if you're not master handicappers by then, you will at least have all the tools that you will need, that with the amount of practice and work that you'll put into it, it'll enable you to become a master handicapper and a winner at this game. Thanks.
Please fast forward and turn.